And the stories of King Tommy or Tommy Farmer, have they been handed down through families, or are you piecing it together? How do you get the stories?
We just get the stories of what we come through with research. Now, even in my father's days, the culture had died out and was dying in his father's days, my grandfather's days. They were a little bit more into surviving and working and making a living in the white man's society, if you like, and getting ahead in that sort of lifestyle. So things like the language and lots of cultural practices had died out by then. So now we've basically got what we can find with some research, and you know, maybe it could go a little bit north and you can utilise some of the practices as well. My theory is that a long, long time ago, however many hundreds or thousands of years ago, the people were a lot more closer together, if you like. You know, there's practices, what we had in Victoria, which they found in central New South Wales, are similar. Similar words in Victoria as in Alice Springs. There's similar words, just a couple of different letters and that. So my belief is that, you know, hundreds of years ago, or possibly a couple of thousands of years ago, people were a lot closer together, and you know, possibly through you know, trade and song lines and trade lines, they just knew stuff that was going on hundreds of miles away. And
so you can use those stories to partially reconstruct a story.
Yeah, there's similar stuff going on all over the country. You know, might not be the same cultural practices, but there'd be similar stuff. Even with the Kulin nations, you know, the half a dozen Kulin language groups, they could understand each other from 40 up to around 70%. So some of them could understand each other a lot more than some of the other people, you know. So some they got on better with, some they didn't get on so well with. So some they intermarried with, so they'd bring the neighbouring language in, and it would, you know, end up working its way into that language, that clan's language, if you like. So
if you have a word that has come from another language group in the Kulin Nation, you can sort of the linguistics and construct a
pattern in there, if you like.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And getting back to canoes and the symbol of the canoes and this research that Fred Carr has found of just these interactions on the riverbanks throughout Victoria between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people at this time of colonisation, at this time where culture is disrupted, but there's also this kind of, it's almost this recognition of a skill that Indigenous people have, a knowledge, a technology that they have that's actually really useful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, Aboriginal people and culture tend to share stuff a lot, you know. If they went out hunting, they'd share the catch, the elders would get the good cuts of meat and etc. And they were more of a sharing society. So if someone come along and was stuck on one side of the river and said to the Koori fella down there, can you help me get across the river? He wouldn't say bugger off, you know. He'd probably say, of course, yes, I'll help you. They were more of a sharing society. So it doesn't surprise me that you know, they used them to do certain things like the bridges and ferry people and stuff across the river.
Well, there's actually stories, not in Dja Dja Wurrung language territory, but other places of white people being rescued in times of flood. saved at risk to the person in the canoe, but the people in the, and it, women too sometimes on the canoes will go out and save miners or
Like I said, those photos at Corranderk, you can see women on the canoes and stuff. So I'd imagine all the people would be taught how to you know, make a canoe and how to sail it up the river, or however they did it with the big stick thing. So in some of those photos, there's 3 and 4 people on it, and a couple of kids and all. So they're quite the, you know, canoe craftsmen.
Well, it's quite a skill. We were talking before about there's up in Janevale, at the Janevale Bridge in Lankuri, there's a newspaper article from the 1870s of a white man who drowns trying to cross the Loddon River in a native canoe, and the native canoe upturns and he falls into the river and drowns. So you needed to know what you were doing.
Yeah, of course. You know, they're not the canoes like we see the American Indians or Daniel Boone in, you know, with the big high sides. They're only basically a flat, well, we say bark, but it's not bark, it's the little cambium wood. So it's only a little thin piece of wood, a couple of centimetres there, and I usually only had little sides on them, little walls, so it would be a bit of an art to master, I imagine. If you weren't very good at it, you could tumble off quite easily.
Yeah, you couldn't just step on one and...
No.
And a lot of Europeans didn't know how to swim, they weren't very savvy at all around water.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realise that, but I could imagine, yeah.
So what do these stories of the canoe, what do the canoe stories say to you? You know, when you hear them, what do you think, what do you feel, what perspective does it?
Oh, look, it gives me a bit of, a high sense of admiration and to think that the Indigenous people were out there helping the early settlers and helping the people who overrun their lands, you know. Like I say, they learnt to adapt, and some of them were quite smart and could see what was happening, so they tried to gently steer that process, if you like, and assimilate into the society. You know, they knew that there's thousands and thousands of white men were coming and they're going to overrun the land. So they had guns and stuff, you know. So they adapted and learnt to assimilate into society and help, you know. So I get a great sense of admiration for those people. Absolutely.
So looking through the eyes of someone like King Tommy, what sort of choices did he have to make? What did he see?
Well, same, he would have sensed that was happening as well, you know. He would have seen a whole change happening in front of his very eyes, his people dying out and getting moved on and moving on in some instances, although they didn't like to move out of their traditional lands particularly. So he would have seen a great life-changing situation unfolding in front of him. So, I'm not surprised that he would want to stay here rather than go to Corranderk, hundreds of miles away out of his tribal lands. He'd rather just stay here and battle on in his own lands and in his own self, you know, be his own person and live semi how he used to, and trying to adapt some white society things into his life.
And what meaning, what significance should we draw on that story today, reflecting back?
The significance would be, a reconciliation type situation, you know, where again, you know, Aboriginal people didn't have a so much as it's a mine or a yours thing. It was a sharing, more of a sharing society. So from to adapt and try and change and get into the white man's way of living, it's a pretty smart survival thing, you know, if you like. And like I say before, it's the technology of making the canoes and stuff. I've seen little blades, stone blades that they made, and they could retouch the blades up to resharpen them. So to work out that sort of industry technology, if you like, it's amazing where that come from. You know, it's some of it's thousands of years old. So
I think it's the length of that history that would, as a modern society, modern in this modern world, that we're still kind of only now coming to grips with.
Absolutely. You know, and I think it says something about this country itself. You know, like I say, about Victoria being overrun so quickly with thousands of people and hundreds of thousands of hard-hoofed animals, that they've actually stamped the earth down that hard that now some of the food resources don't grow anymore. I mean, the Murnong daisy, the yam daisy, that's virtually extinct in most parts of Victoria now, but it was fields of yellow of the Murnong. But the hard-hoofed animals have eaten it down and stampled the ground down so hard, and if you look at all the Australian animals, they've all got soft paws. And so that just says something about the interaction between, you know, the wildlife and the country in itself. So it was, you know, a quieter interaction with the country and the people and the animals and things.
And what would you like to see told as part of this story that we're producing? What message would you really like to be in this story?
A good strong message would be that, you know, we're starting to realise now more communities, I'm saying in town, non-Indigenous communities, are starting to know and understand and that about local history, Indigenous history, if you like. So for all these little interactions to happen with the non-Indigenous society, that sort of shows mostly a friendly peoples, you know, and that they adapted. There's lots of stories about fighting and, you know, the two societies clashing and stuff. Of course, that's going to happen in early times, but it generally shows that the people were friendly and adaptive, and you know, would just take on whatever happened, that they could adapt and assimilate. And you know, but it shows an ingenious people, I think.
Mm. It sure does.
Yeah.
Is it important that we had this conversation here today?
We're putting the stories out there into society, into the communities. The more we can make people think about the earlier times and the Indigenous people, you know, if I can make one more person think about it a bit more, well, I'm sort of doing my role, you know. So, absolutely, it's important that we get these stories out there and told, and more importantly, you know, it's the kids, it's the children we've got to focus on and teach about these things so they can pass the knowledge on again to the next generations. We've got a strong push for that in our community. It's all about teaching the kids. So if some of the kids can hear some of these stories, you can see them sometimes sitting quietly and still for an hour while we talk. And for that to happen to primary age kids, it's amazing, you know. They are quite interested in some of these stories, particularly of, you know, men going up on bark canoes up the river and ferrying people and goods across the river. I know some kids would love to hear about that.
And the canoe itself, is it, what meaning does it have to us now, this Indigenous canoe?
It's got a lot of meaning. It helped settle the country, if you like, or you know, particularly our country, Victoria here, or Central Victoria. You know, that could be the difference between some settlements being established and some not, perhaps. It's a huge story and a huge impact, and you know, it shows that people just helped, you know, and in lots of ways, you know, not just with their canoes, but there's a whole list of ways that Indigenous people helped the early explorers and settlers, and even down to Mitchell, one of the first explorers. So, I think it's huge.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or comment as we've had this conversation?
No, but just that, you know, there is probably a whole book of these stories out there that some of we still haven't found, and some we have, and some we need to explore a bit more. So it would probably go beyond my lifetime, you know. It'd be probably kids that I talk to who will take this role on and still be researching when they're young adults. So if I can help get that started, well, you know, I'll be a happy old man. So, yeah.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.